somebody. It was about 10 years ago when I first came into AA, and I was visiting my third meeting. So I was only 3 days sober, and as I'm sure all of you know, at that point you're really, really scared and nervous. So I went to a meeting over at the Lutheran Hospital, a Lutheran church. Yeah, there were a lot of people from the hospital there, you're right. And the secretary was our dear, dear friend, Hawaii Ken. And all I can honest to God remember from that meeting was he talking about the importance of being in service when it comes to Alcoholics Anonymous and how much that'll help you keep sober. And it stuck with me. It stuck with me. And I'm not as much as in service as Kenny is, but the idea and the service duties that I do commit to have kept me sober, happily sober, for 10 years. It's bittersweet that Kenny is here tonight because he's leaving for San Diego. The moving vans come on Friday. He is going to be missed. We all know that. But the most important thing that we have to remember is to keep him in our prayers so that he can start a new life all over with back there, down there in San Diego. And Kenny, I love you. We all love you.
I think we should do a synchronized aloha for him. So on the count of three, ready? One, two, three. Aloha! All right, well now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to Jim.
I'm Jim and I'm an alcoholic. Excuse me. Hold on. Are my Kleenex down there? Do you have any Kleenex? Okay. On December 31st at 7 in the morning in 1937, an alcoholic was born. I'm convinced to this day that I was born with a predisposition to alcoholism, physically, mentally, emotionally, and psychologically. If my analogy to this is coffee. A bottle of instant coffee is coffee, but it really isn't coffee until you add water to it. And so I was born as a, you know, an instant cup of alcoholism, and didn't turn into full-blown alcoholism until alcohol was actually added. But so that's my contention, and I got a whole list of things here as reminders, but I don't have the time to go through it all. So, you know, probably the first indication that I might have a problem with substances was when I was 4 years old. I have no idea why, but I know gasoline and alcohol are, chemically almost identical. And I love the smell of gasoline. I don't know whether anybody else here did, but I love the smell of gasoline so much that my dad took us, he was taking some stuff to the dump, and my sisters and myself climbed in the car, and on the way to the dump I was trying to figure out how to smell gasoline. And in my little 4-year-old head, I knew it went in the side of the car, and I thought it came out the tailpipe. So when he stopped to dump his stuff off and get back in the car, I was down at the tailpipe trying to huffing on the exhaust trying to get, and I was really angry because I couldn't get that smell back, and he came charging out of the car yelling, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" So I wasn't right from the start, you know. I was an odd, neurotic child with a lot of psychological problems and did really weird things. And the book says liquor was but a symptom. We had to get down to causes and conditions. And then it goes on, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. And then it all talks about resentment being our number one offender, and accepting later, it doesn't, actually it's in a story in the back of the book, it says accepting life on life's terms, that's become a saying in AA, and I couldn't do any, I was fear, full of fear and self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity from the beginning, resentments. And I just didn't seem to be able to live life on life's terms. I grew up in a picture-perfect family. Everybody in that family was very successful and very normal. And I was a little weird misfit. And, you know, my fears in my younger days, it was... I grew up during the Second World War, which was a really frightening time for a kid. I can remember 4 years old, we had air raid drills, and we had to all go down to the kitchen at 2 in the morning and pull the black shades down so no light would show so the bombers couldn't find out where we were. And I can remember sitting there as a four-year-old, coming to the conclusion that if a bomb came crashing through the ceiling of the kitchen, my dad wasn't going to be able to catch it, and we were all going to be blown to smithereens. So right then, I knew there were things could happen to you in life that nobody could prevent happening to you, and that scared the hell out of me at four. For some reason, I got the idea that I might could be kidnapped, too. I guess it was a famous kidnapping back then, and I guess that had been in the papers or something, but I couldn't sleep at night, I couldn't go to bed at night, I knew somebody was going to put a ladder up to the second story window and climb up and kidnap me, and, you know, I had to roll my head when I went to sleep every night, because if I rolled my head, I couldn't hear them coming, you know, so I was weird, and... Then a neighborhood kid across the street, his appendix burst and he almost lost his life, and I knew from that point on that my appendix was going to burst, and you know, so I just had all these fears. That appendix, my hypochondria was so bad. We used to go on trips, you know, 6 or 8 hour trips on vacation, and I'd be looking for signs to hospitals in case my appendix burst. So I was a little weird kid. One of the weirdest things in this, the pancake griddle story, my parents were gone, they had whoever was feeding us that night, the pancake griddle was open in the dining room, and I was 5 years old, I walked by and looked at it, and as I walked by, I thought, boy, I bet that's hot, and I walked about 10 feet further, and for some reason, I don't know, even know today, I turned around, went back and put my hand right on the pancake griddle, turned to an instant blister, hurt like hell, and I thought, why did you do that, you know? And, you know, so then I got afraid of myself, like, you know, my parents used to let us walk across the George Washington Bridge when we went to New York City. You could do it back then, and I get in the middle of the bridge and just get terrified of myself, like, what if I suddenly decide to throw myself off the bridge, you know, and so I had to live with all that crap. So there's lots of other things, and, you know, I was bullied and picked on a lot, and I didn't like that either. When I did strange things and didn't seem to, other normal kids didn't seem to do that stuff, but when I turned 12, I copped it in my first few resentments, I think, the major resentments. When I was 12 years old, we had a bedroom and a bath in the third story of the house we lived in. It was a big house. I was jumping on the bed at 12. Puberty hadn't hit yet. And I was thinking about life, and the Korean War was going on, and I was 12, and in 6 years I'd be 18, and I could possibly get drafted at the age of 18 and have to go to war and be killed. And I hadn't even started living yet. And so I got angry at God because I wasn't born a woman, because women didn't have to go to war. And besides that, they had a pretty good deal, because my dad got up and went to work at 6 every morning, didn't get home till 6 at night. And my mother at that time was going to bridge clubs and book groups and her AAUW and meetings, and she just seemed to have a better deal. Dad had to go to work and earn all the money to support that, and she got to go and play. So I figured I had a bad deal, which led to some peculiar behavior. I won't mention what. Very brief period of time, I was a cross-dresser. So, anyway, the other thing I was mad at up there in that bedroom when I was jumping around in the bed was we were brought up with the idea that when you turned 18, you went to college. When you got out of college, you had to start your working life. And what I couldn't understand was I had a pretty good life going. We were upper middle class. And I didn't understand why when I turned 18 and went to college and graduated, I was going to have to start on the bottom and spend the rest of my life working my way up to where I already was. That didn't make any sense to me. So I had a few resentments towards God about those things, and there were other things. Self-pity, I think, was a big part of my childhood, because I didn't like being picked on and bullied. And it just occurred to me the other day, I heard this song more than once. My mother, when I got into periods of self-pity and started moaning and groaning about things, she'd sing to me this little song. Nobody loves me, everybody hates me, I'm going in the garden to eat worms. Nice, fat, juicy ones, small, skinny, slimy ones. Golly, how they wiggle when they squirm. And, so I wasn't getting any pity from her. And then I was restless, irritable, and discontent. So I had all the symptoms of alcoholism before I started drinking. Then puberty hit, and that totally screwed me up. And experimenting around with this newfound pleasure, which you weren't allowed to talk about in those days. It was the 40s, and sex wasn't openly talked about, So there was nobody to help you understand what was going on, what you're supposed to do with these feelings. And experimenting around, I acquired some guilt. And I responded to guilt. I know this now. I didn't know what I was doing then, by adopting a whole pattern of obsessive compulsive personality disorders. If you've ever seen the TV show Monk, or As Good As It Gets with Jack Nicholson, I made up all these rituals to please God. I guess I was setting my own penance up or something. And I had to get the window open just right at night, or I couldn't go to bed. And I'd spend 2 hours jumping in and out of bed, getting the window straightened out. And I couldn't step on the cracks in the sidewalk. A 10-minute walk home from school would take me 2 hours. And then my sister said, about 10 years ago when I was visiting her, she said, that would explain why you had to turn around 3 times every time you came in the front door. I didn't know anybody noticed. And my mother came to me one night and says, "You don't seem to be very happy. Would you like to talk to somebody about it?" And I said, "Yeah." So in my sophomore year of high school, she sent me to a psychiatrist several towns away where nobody would know. Back then there was a stigma. So once a month I had to go to him, and It took about 2 years for him to drag out of me what I was feeling so guilty about, and it wasn't really all that much. These days people laugh at it, but it was to me, and I don't know. I still think I kept a little few routines. You know, I turned out to be an accountant, and I used to have to make the numbers just right in my spreadsheets, or I'd go back, and there were little things like that. So anyway, in seventh grade, I got kind of tired of being myself a little bit, and I sent off for the Charles Atlas bodybuilding course from the back of a comic book, and I started doing his exercises faithfully every morning, and that made a big change in my life, because I got in with the jocks and I dumped my friends from my childhood who I was pissed at for bullying me all that time. And I wasn't going to let anybody kick sand in my face anymore. And I lost my train of thought. So, that's because I'm old. Anyway, when I got into high school, it was in the next town, because we didn't have a high school at that time in Glen Rock. I lived in Glen Rock, New Jersey. It was an upper middle class community, and I played football and tried other sports. I tried a lot of sports, wasn't any good at any of them, but I tried anyway. And not many kids drank in high school. I don't know why, except the kind of community we were in. I don't even remember knowing where a liquor store was. And occasionally, kids would come to school with a hangover. They'd gotten into their parents' liquor cabinets. And once in high school, I got into jazz, and I wanted to take a group of kids into New York City and to go see Lionel Hampton play in a jazz club. And we went in, and they all got served drinks, and I just ordered milk. I had no interest in drinking. I wasn't a very good student. I was sandwiched between my sister and my older sister and my younger sister, and they were both straight A students, and that was another resentment, because my parents could not figure out what was wrong with me. Why couldn't I be like my sisters? That was just obvious for years to me, and as hard as I tried, I couldn't be like my sisters. And I somehow got into college and went off to Lehigh University. I don't know how I passed the college entrance exams, because I never cracked a book in high school. I just listened in class, and if that wasn't good enough, that wasn't good enough. And I had anywhere between a B and D and F. But anyway, I must have aced the college entrance exams, because I got accepted at one Ivy League school, so I don't know. Now, it was at Lehigh at that time, it was 3,000 men, no women. It was an all-men school. It was an engineering school primarily, and they drank there. I'd never seen drinking like I saw drinking there, and I just thought it was stupid, and I thought they were funny, and I laughed at their, the guy climbing up the drain spout on the building across the way and getting to the second floor and the drain spout coming off, So, after my first semester, my dad's company moved into Memphis, and he thought it might be better if I... Actually, I didn't study much at Lehigh either, because I had no study habits. And my girlfriend from high school, which we'd had a torrid relationship in high school, you couldn't actually have sex in those days, because if you got a girl pregnant, you had to marry her, and everybody knew Barry, so you did your best without actually having sex, if you know what I mean. But I was hooked. She picked me up. I didn't pick her up. And in those days, you went steady, and you had friendship bracelets so everybody knew who you belonged to and all that crap. And she went to Bucknell, which is about 200 miles away, and I spent a lot of my weekends spending my dad's money on bus trips to Bucknell and back when I should be studying. And I wasn't doing very well at Lehigh. I got an A, B, a C, and two Fs. And came within 1/100th of a point of flunking out. So Dad thought it would be better if I was closer to home, so we went to the University of Mississippi. he told me it was the Harvard of the South. They told him that, and it was a little better than it wasn't even as good as a high school, I don't think. But, sorry if anybody's from Mississippi, but and it was segregated, and I'd been to integrated school, so that was like culture shock to me. And I forgot when I was at Lehigh, because I didn't know how to contend with all this emotional garbage that I collected over the course of my childhood, I made an altar call at a Bethlehem, at a revival meeting in a Bethlehem, in a church in downtown Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, Brethren Church, and gave my life to God. And that something did happen, but then it created more problems because now you weren't supposed to have sex before marriage. I mean, that was the rule, the Christian rule was. So now I had this new rule which just made the conflicts greater. So I went to the University of Mississippi, and I did a Bible study with a girl in the Youth for Christ movement, I guess she was in. And she arranged for me to go to a summer camp between my freshman and sophomore year in Colorado, and to my father's chagrin, we fought about it for months, and then he said, if you can get there on this, you can go, and it was $40, and it was the price of a one-way train ticket to Colorado Springs. I didn't get that. So I went there, and I didn't get paid. You just got room and board, and it was way up in the Rocky Mountains someplace towards Cripple Creek. And I had a minister from someplace come and talk to the camp workers every Wednesday night, and there was one minister, I've never forgotten his speech. His whole hour and a half was proving to us that Jesus led him to believe that drinking was okay. And his rationale was, by being able to go down to the corner bar and have a couple beers with the boys, he could save those poor souls for Jesus. And I thought, what a concept. I never thought of that. How can I help anybody on the other side of life if I don't know what the other side of life is like? So I went home, talked to my minister. He thought it was a bad idea. He says, I've tried to work with too many alcoholics with too little success to recommend that if you don't now drink, that you start drinking. And I walked out of his office thinking he didn't understand what I said. And then a few months later, he shot himself in the head with a shotgun, supposedly when he was cleaning it. So I really thought he didn't know what he... And I wrote that girl a letter, and she wrote me back a 6-page letter, and in effect it said she didn't agree with what I was thinking about doing, but she said, I know if you've made up your mind to do this, there's nothing I can do to change it. Now, she must have had some experience with alcoholic father or something in her life, because I didn't get it. And sure enough, I went to my third college with my junior year, still didn't know what I wanted to be. And there was a guy on campus, I wanted to be like him. He was just the kind of guy I wanted to be. So I thought, made up my mind to get to know him. And he liked to drink some, so I started drinking with him. And that turned me in from a, you know, freeze-dried alcoholic into the actual alcoholic. I didn't drink normally from the beginning. I drank, every time I started drinking, I wanted to drink until I passed out. And that was for the next 19, 20 years. That's the way I drank, and mostly at night. The first really bad drunk I had was shortly after I met David. And David and his wife came over to spend New Year's Eve at our house. And the parents left us alone back in the den, which was in the back of the house, just off the garage. And when I woke up in the morning, I was laying on the couch. Everybody was gone. I pooped, I peed, and I vomited on myself, and it had all dried. It was 6 in the morning, and fortunately my parents hadn't gotten up yet. My girlfriend, who was going to be my wife, was asleep in my room, and I was able to get up and change my clothes and throw away my clothes because they were beyond recovery. So that was my first bad drunk. And over the years, you know, it took me about 6 years to get to the point where I could drink without having hangovers. And I got into that blessed state where I could drink. You'd get home from work, I could drink, I could get into that euphoric state for 3 or 4 hours every night, and I loved it there. It was wonder world to me. I could make all these plans and solve all the world's problems. I couldn't remember all that when I woke up, but I knew it was good while I was there. So I quit drinking about 10 years into my drinking, and I married my girlfriend between my junior and senior year of college, which was a bad idea because I had no way of supporting her. I didn't have any idea what I wanted to be. Oh, and one other big contributor to my alcoholism, the crowning blow was when I got out of the Air Force. You couldn't get a job out of college back then unless you were draft free. So when I got out of the Air Force, I was looking for jobs in New York, and for some reason I was in some kind of a zone, and I was acing the Wunderlich test. Every place I went, they gave me the Wunderlich test. It's a 50-question test. They give you 20 minutes to do it, and I was scoring 48, 49, and 50 on it. Then I went to Teachers Annuities, and they gave me a 4-hour test. I finished it in 2.5 hours. The guy took it out back to grade it. Came back out after grading it, and he said, "Are you some kind of a genius?" And I said, "No, why?" He says, "You scored much higher than anybody we've ever given this test to." And right then, I became smarter than my sisters, smarter than my father, smarter than anybody I knew. I was now a genius, and I ran with that. Consequently, if I'm obnoxious these days, it's because of that test. And when I got sober, the president of the national company I worked for was out for a profit plan presentation, and I was like 4 months sober, and we were hiking up a trail in Yosemite. It was at Yosemite, and they rented a cabin for 4 days and stocked it full of beer, and I was 4 months sober. We were hiking up there, me and the plant manager, my drinking buddy, and the president were ahead of everybody else. And he says, "Kane, you know what?" He says, "You've just got a beautiful mosaic of life created." He says, "It's just absolutely beautiful." He says, "There's only one thing wrong with it." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "You put yourself in the middle." So, talk about ego. I guess I had one. People could see it. So, anyway, gosh, I haven't gotten sober yet. So, my wife divorced me 4 years before I got sober, and I got involved with an alcoholic addict woman. I had no experience with drugs, so I didn't know what she was into. I was 36, and she was 30. I met her right next door at what used to be the El Presidente there, you know. I had an inkling that night I was going to meet the woman of my dreams. I mean, I had a holy knowing experience. I'd had them before, and I left the house knowing I was going to... Didn't turn out to be the one I thought it was, but she was sitting down at the end of the bar, and she looked angry. And I thought, she looks like how I feel. I'm going to go down and get to know her. So I walked up behind her and started talking to her. She was drinking a red beer. It was about 11:30 at night, and she got nasty with me, and I backed off. And then once she turned around and then told me to come over and got my phone number and called me, and that started a beautiful 3-year relationship with an absolutely crazy woman. We couldn't, at one point, I was paying my ex-wife alimony and child support. I'd leased a house where we were going to live happily ever after for this girlfriend and I, and I found out I couldn't live with her because I was going to lose my job. She was into lots of drugs, so I rented an apartment, so I was paying on 3 places, wondering why I had no money. I didn't move. I moved just 3 blocks away in case she needed me. You know, Superman had nothing on me. What's that song? I'll be there if you need me. And my relationship with her led me right into AA. 7 years before I got sober, I started praying about my problems and my misery and my... When we were in Harrisonburg, Virginia, I used to write my prayers in a notebook, and I promised myself I'd say anything to God that I wanted to say, and he'd have to be big enough to handle it. And a lot of I said ministers would say you shouldn't print. But the only bad thing about it was my wife eventually found the book. It wasn't good. But I think God started to work in my life when I started getting up every morning and writing those prayers about my life and my misery and how bad I felt. And a whole sequence of events led me down the road till I met this girl. And I told this story before. She called me up one morning and said that she'd come home. She'd been out, and she was drunk, and she got her .22 out, and she was going to shoot her four girls. And I said, "What happened?" And she said, "Well, I passed out before I could do it, and I need help." So we hooked her up with a counselor in the mental health center that she'd been to before, and he put her in Tulare County Detox House. It used to be over in Tulare. It's no longer there. And that was the first time I'd seen anybody get sober. And that's the first time I ever saw a big book. And she was in there 6 days, and I went over every day and watched her to see what she was going through. And then later on, she beat me up because I wouldn't take my underwear off. No, she beat me up. It's a long story, but the essence to the story is she blackened my eye, and I went to work the next day, and I swore I was never going to have anything to do with her again, and we were done. And that Thursday she called, it was like 4 days later, and it was St. Patrick's Day, and the black eye had turned greenish. I found that kind of funny, that it was green on St. Patrick's Day. And she wanted to know if I wanted to go to marriage counseling. And I thought, that's interesting, we're not married. That sounds like fun. So we went to marriage counseling. And he threw her out right away. He said, he asked her, "Are you going to stop drinking?" And she said, "Yeah, everything but beer." He said, "That's not, you know," and they thought about it for a little while, and he kicked her out. And I went for 37 more weeks. Finally, I said, "Just tell me what to do." And he said, "Get rid of her and quit drinking." So I went home and I got rid of her. She got her children and went to Illinois to live with her mother. And I came back and I said, "Okay, I got rid of her." And he says, "Now quit drinking." I said, this was a year before I got sober. And I said, "How do you do that?" He said, "Well, you don't want to go to AA, do you?" And I said, "Well, no." So we finished the session. He got up and said, "I probably shouldn't say this to you, but I'm going to go home and have two stiff martinis." That was my experience with mental health. So, a year later, I was living in the Oak Tree Inn. I was down and out. I had my job, but I didn't have anything else. My best friend didn't even like to be with me. I had to borrow my son's 10-speed bike to get around on. I had people that worked under me picking me up to take me to work, and had my final drink on July 25th. I put every last ounce of energy that I had left in me into quitting drinking. After 3 hours, I quit forever. I knew it. I had the incentive to quit. And 3 hours later, I had to go out and buy a bottle of booze, and I just sat there in my chair, and the sense of doom just washed over me, and I just said, "God, what am I going to do now?" And he told me, he answered me. I call them holy knowing experiences, but the voice said, go look up Jack. That worked. Go look up Jack and tell him you need help. That you have a drinking problem and you need help tomorrow morning. So I finished drinking what I had. I went to bed. I got up and did exactly what that voice told me to do. Jack had been coming. Don't tell me God doesn't work in mysterious ways. Remember that prayer that I wrote 7 years before, those prayers in that book I wrote? Jack had been coming into my office for a year once a month and talking to me about how he was getting sober in AA. He was like 30 years older than me, maybe 25 years older than me. And when I went to Jack, I thought that because he'd been coming into my office, maybe he had an inkling that I had a problem, and that's why he was talking to me. So I took him to the coffee room, and I told him, I said, I've got a drinking problem, I need help. And he was the most surprised person in the world. He had no idea I had a drinking problem. So I'm only halfway through my story, I'm sorry, but there's no time left, so I have to end it. But a song came on the radio, and it's one of my favorite songs. I hadn't heard in a long time. It's Joan Osborne's What If God Were One of Us, Just a Stranger on a Bus. Jack was one of us, and he was just a stranger on the bus trying to get home. And he was come part of that, being the stranger on the bus, was he was on my bus that night. And, you know, the whole song, if you ever listen to it, is about God shows up in ordinary people. What if he were one of us? And Jack took me to my first three meetings and got me started in AA. And AA had all the answers for my drinking problem and a lot of the answers for my living problem. And it's been what I've learned here and what I've... Having been involved in the program for 40 years, I've been able to stay sober for 40 years. So I've been sober twice as long as I drank, and I've been sober for more than half my life now. And I'm just so grateful to God, as I understand him, in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm sorry I couldn't squeeze in the last 40 years, but the first time I spoke here was 5 years ago. On the 25th, and I more or less told this story. No, I told. That time I started with my sobriety and worked through my sobriety, only touching on things from my past. And last year, when Bill asked me to substitute for a speaker who didn't show up, I decided to tell the first part of my story. So I screwed up this time. I told the first part of my story again. So you have to get them to book me for next year or something, so you can get the second part of my story. Anyway, that's all.